right, folks, getting organized here. It's time for Politics and Science. It's a little bit after 5, and today on Politics and Science, I'm happy to welcome to the airwaves over here in WRNW land, Arne Gundersen, and I got to bring him up right now, if I can remember how. All right, Arne, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, good. I can barely hear you. I'll turn my headphones up. All right. Well, welcome to Politics and Science. It's June 1st, 2009, and we're going to be talking about nuclear power and Vermont Yankee specifically today. And Arne Gundersen, my guest, is, I know you're a nuclear engineer, Arne, and I don't really have your bio in front of me, so I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself, if you'd be so kind.
Cool. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, my name is Arne Gundersen, S-E-N, for those of you who wrote it down. And I live in Burlington. When I got out of college, I went to work for a nuclear reactor company in Connecticut, and then moved on to work for a company that serviced nuclear reactors around the country, where I became a senior VP. And in 1990, I found some license violations. I told the president about them, and he fired me, and then sued me for $1.5 million. And that led to congressional hearings by John Glenn, which exonerated me. But in any event, I moved on to a teaching career, and I do nuclear consulting as well. I teach now at CCD, and I do nuclear consulting as well. And I was picked by Peter Shumlin to be on the Vermont Yankee Oversight Panel.
Okay, I'm having trouble hearing you, Arne. You're on a landline, is that right?
Yes, I'm on a landline.
Okay, maybe if you just speak directly into the mouthpiece.
Okay, hang on here. Is that any better?
That's a lot better. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So you were picked by Peter Shumlin to be on a panel to assess the safety of Vermont Yankee?
We were not allowed to look at the safety of Vermont Yankee. The public service, the Department of Public Service, and the Attorney General's office told us we could not look at the safety of Vermont Yankee. There's some jurisdictional issues there between the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which looks at safety, and the state, which is prohibited from looking directly at safety.
Mm-hmm. I see. Well, maybe we'll get into the regulatory politics of this in a minute. Perhaps you could talk a little more about your experience as a nuclear engineer, as a vice president of a company that did maintenance or oversaw the maintenance of nuclear power plants. Is that what you did in your former?
Well, the groups I ran, and it's interesting because a lot of it wraps right back around to Vermont Yankee. Mm-hmm. The groups I ran were in writing of procedures. Now, it sounds like it's such a routine issue, but on a nuclear plant, they may have, 6,000 to 10,000 different procedures, as long as 150 pages apiece. And getting them all right and making sure that every valve is turned in exactly the right direction is a pretty complicated thing. So One group I ran did that. Another group I ran did ultrasonic inspections of pipes, which means you send a sound wave into a pipe, and if it's the correct thickness, the sound wave will bounce off the back wall and come back in a time you can calculate.
Hmm.
But if there's a crack in the wall, the sound wave bounces back faster. So it's a little bit like police radar, and we would look for cracks in pipes. And then another group I worked that worked for me did decommissioning, which was, the dismantlement of nuclear power plants. So I dismantled the first relatively large nuclear reactor ever dismantled was a shipping port. My group figured out how to do it. And I also dismantled and was involved in dismantling a couple other facilities around the country that had radioactive material in them. They weren't nuclear power plants, but they were contaminated facilities that had radiation in them.
But which was the first reactor you decommissioned? What was the name of it?
It was called Shippingport.
And where is that?
It's in Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania.
It's in, it shares a site with the Beaver Valley units, but it was the very first commercial nuclear power plant. That is, a power plant that generated electricity that fed into a grid.
I see. And do you see any similarities between that decommissioning job and Vermont Yankee?
Well, they both went over budget. That's a similarity. Vermont Yankee is larger.
Uh-huh.
And it's also a much more contaminated plant. Because it's a boiling water reactor.
Yeah.
Boiling water reactors in general are about 30% more expensive to dismantle than a pressurized water reactor. There's more radiation spread throughout the entire plant. So Vermont Yankee is a boiling water reactor, which is the more expensive one to dismantle.
I see. Maybe you could, if you know this, give us a brief history of Vermont Yankee and how its particular design fits into the spectrum of nuclear power designs.
I do.
Okay.
Vermont Yankee came online in 1972, but that means it was designed in the mid to late 60s. It takes about 5 years to build, so they began building it in about 1967, which means they went to design it in about 1965.
Mm-hmm.
Give you an idea there, no one had computers. They had monster mainframes, but nobody had laptops or any kind of computer. Most of the calculations were done by hand using slide rules.
Mm-hmm.
So Vermont Yankee's design is called a Mark One. That means it was the very first design that they came out with. And as they were building Vermont Yankee, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission realized it made a mistake and should not have built Vermont Yankee.
Hmm.
And we actually came across some memos by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And where they specifically talk about the fact that, whoa, this was a mistake, and I'm scrolling up to briefly read you the memo right now. The people that wrote it were really high level people within the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. A guy named Stephen Hanauer he reported directly to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
Hmm.
And hang on here. I'm scrolling.
Okay.
I got it.
All right.
Okay, I got it. If anyone has ever seen the cross-section of this plant, the nuclear reactor is sort of like a big pressure cooker. And it is inside a thing called a containment. And on this particular reactor, it's about a 1-inch thick steel cylinder that sits around this pressure cooker with a little bulb on the bottom. It looks like a light bulb hanging in upside down.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, this is what this is the correspondence that the NRC has. This is a direct quote. I recommend that the AEC is the predecessor to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. I recommend that the AEC develop a policy of discouraging further use of the pressure suppression containment. Now, that's what Vermont Yankee is, a pressure suppression containment.
Mm-hmm.
Steve's idea to ban pressure suppression containment schemes is attractive. And then he goes on to say, however, acceptance of pressure suppression containments by all elements of the nuclear field, including regulatory and the Advisory Committee on Reactor Safeguards, is firmly embedded in the conventional wisdom. Reversal of this hallowed policy, particularly at this time, could well be the end of nuclear power. It would throw into question the operation of licensed plants and would generally create more turmoil than I can stand. This is in 1972.
Wow.
Right within a month of when PermiInc was starting up, at very high levels in the NRC, they were talking about how, you know, that design was a mistake. So the design, that's not the only area, but the design of PermiInc could not be licensed today. But we made a deal for 40 years, and you know, as Entergy likes to say, a deal is a deal.
Yeah.
And that deal expires in 2012. They had a couple of long outages at PermiInc. They had a 10-month outage back in the 80s where they had a major replacement of pipe, and they've had some mechanical failures that have been, you know, catastrophic. The most recent was the transformer fire, and then the cooling tower collapse. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty quick summary of the history. In general, as a plant's running like this, they always leak a little bit of radiation. Is that right?
Yes. Especially the boiling water reactors are a dirtier plant than the pressurized water reactor. When PermiInc first came online, it released a lot of radiation. Since about 1990, there's been fewer and fewer problems with the nuclear fuel, and it's released less and less radiation as part of its normal airborne and liquid-borne releases. As the liquids have been going down and the airborne's have been going down, the other thing that they emit is going up, and that's the just like in a chest X-ray, PermiInc sends out not radiation, but radioactive waves called gamma rays.
Mm-hmm.
And since the uprate, PermiInc has sent out a lot more gamma rays than it did before the uprate, almost 40% more radiation since the uprate than before the uprate. Now, this isn't radioactive atoms. The radioactive atoms are in the plant, but the radioactive atoms decay and send out an energy ray called a gamma ray.
Mm-hmm.
And the site boundary dose at PermiInc is very near to pushing and exceeding the state limit. That report should be out sometime in June, and we'll know for sure what happened last year.
So basically, So the plant is getting hotter and hotter. Is that right? In terms of radiation.
Yes. The radioactive rays coming out of the plant are about 40% more, even though the uprate was only a 20% uprate, which is the largest uprate in the country, by the way. Even though it was a 20% uprate, that caused about a 40% increase in radiation. Not exactly, but it's a pretty good round number.
Mm-hmm.
The plant got much hotter after the uprate and is now borderline exceeding the state's limits. Every time the plant exceeds the state limits, the state changes the fudge factor that they apply. There's a fudge factor the state is using called the dose conversion factor. And every time PermiInc dose goes up, they change this dose conversion factor to make it look like the dose goes down. It's now about 60% of what it used to be. And I don't know if your readers have been following it or not, but the Department of Health is in the process of evaluating whether or not it's appropriate for them to be using this fudge factor, this dose conversion factor. Were it not for that, PermiInc would have to shut down. It's over the state limit at the site boundary. And but again, the state keeps changing this fudge factor to make it appear to be under the state limit.
Okay, well, I'm a little confused. Let's talk a little bit about the regulation of nuclear power plants. Now, you've told me that you can't look at the safety of the plant, and I've heard also that the state can't rule on the safety of the plant. That's completely up to a federal agency, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And yet you're saying that the state can set standards that the plant cannot exceed without having to shut down. So is there a...
That's a great question. And the What happened there was way back in the 70s, the original owners of Vermont Yankee entered into an agreement with the state. And the NRC was not part of the agreement. But the agreement was to keep the dose, the 20 millirem, it's just a measure of radiation, mm-hmm. which is lower than the 25 that any other site in the country has to meet. So Vermont negotiated a deal with the previous owners of Vermont Yankee that because Vermont Yankee entered into it willingly, takes precedence over the federal limit. Federal limit is 25.
I see. So it's a separate, basically, contract.
Right.
Between.
Right. And Vermont Yankee didn't have to do it. You know, they could have dug in their heels and said, no, the nuclear regulatory governs. We're gonna live with their limits. Mm-hmm. But at the time, you have to remember, there's two things that have changed. At the time, there was no uprate. So that was the radiation was much, much lower. And the other thing at the time, they weren't storing nuclear fuel outside. The spent nuclear fuel now is stored alongside of the power plant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's highly radioactive as well. So for those two reasons, we're seeing higher exposure at the site boundary than people anticipated back in the 70s.
I see. So and the storage fuel is contributing to the gamma rays, the waves that are...
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
So that's part of the...
There's two main sources, well, several sources, but the biggest source is the turbine. If you look at, if you can imagine for my Yankee, there's that big box that sticks up, and that's the reactor building.
Mm-hmm.
And we should talk about that, too, on a, from a tourist standpoint. But next to it is a long building that's not as tall. And that's where the steam turbine is. And it's very long, and it spins at 1,800 RPM.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what steam goes through. And as the steam expands, it spins the turbine and creates the electricity. Well, that steam in a boiling water reactor is very radioactive.
Hmm.
And not only is it radioactive, but it has a very penetrating gamma ray when it's very powerful. So it goes a long way.
Hmm.
And so, in any event, that the turbine probably contributes about 80% of the radiation from Vermont Yankee. And other sources, especially the fuel, contribute the other 20%.
And in terms of particulate radiation, actual radioactive particles escaping, does the steam ever blow off? Like, do they have a pressure relief system?
Yes, they have a pressure relief system. Normally, it relieves into the containment and is filtered and goes out the stack. If there had been, if there were to be an accident, that would be a different story. You would release radioactive steam into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
But normally, when the pressure valves release, they release into the torus, into the containment building, and whatever particulate is captured. You know, it's not perfect. They run it through charcoal filters and release it up that big stack.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always radiation being released. I can't claim that there's a lot of particulate radiation release, or atomic particles of radiation release.
Right. And then in terms of they do a lot of cooling, I guess. That's key to both the reactor itself and the storage of the rods. Is that right? Or no?
The rods...
I'm wondering about the cooling system.
Well, let's talk about the reactor itself first.
Okay.
They use an enormous amount of water from the river to keep the plant cool.
Mm-hmm.
So on one... They have this thing called a condenser. And our panel discovered that the condenser is not in very good shape. That's the thing that sprung a leak last year. And... It's on its last leg. I think everybody would agree.
Was that all the pictures in the paper of the water pouring out? That was the condenser?
That was the cooling towers.
Oh, okay.
That was the cooling towers. That's a different thing. But in the winter, the plant doesn't need the cooling towers.
Oh.
It can run the Connecticut River through the condenser and right back out again, and it warms the Connecticut River. In the summer, when the river flow is low and when the river is quite warm, there's not enough water in the river to cool the reactor. So that's when they use those cooling towers, which is the thing that collapses the water pouring out.
I see.
That water pouring out is river water. It's not radioactive water. It's on the radioactive water is on one side of a heat exchanger pipe, and other water, the river water is on the other side. And so you take heat from the radioactive water, and you put it into the Connecticut River.
Mm-hmm.
And in the summer, not only do you put it into the Connecticut River, but you also send it up as steam in those cooling towers.
And have they ever had a leak in the cooling system where the radioactive water leaked into the river water?
There's contamination on site in the areas of the cooling towers where, yeah, there has been... There was some radiation that got into that secondary side, into the river water, and went up and settled down back, they claim, settled down back on site. And in the area between the cooling towers, there's measurable radiation in the ground, yeah.
Mm. I see. So it's not something that got back in the river?
No, there's radiation in the river, too.
Oh.
Now, what they do is they'll sample... organisms in the river and look for radiation. And there's some organisms you'll look for. And you're going to be looking for things like strontium and cesium and cobalt. But the other element that's released all the time from a reactor that nobody talks about, something called tritium.
Mm-hmm.
And tritium is heavy water. It's chemically identical to water, H2O. But instead of a hydrogen atom, it's got a heavy hydrogen atom that's created inside the reactor.
Huh.
So chemically, it looks exactly like water. There's no way to differentiate it. But it's poisonous.
Huh.
It's radioactive. So if and it can't be filtered, because you've got to remember, this stuff looks just like water. It can't be filtered, and it can't be removed in any way. Chemically, it's identical to water. So there's tritium releases that go into the Connecticut River all the time.
And what's the source? Which part?
They're made inside the nuclear reactor, and because it's identical to regular water, even when they strip out all the radioactive material from the, let's say they got a leak in the plant.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say they clean up all the strontium and the cobalt and the cesium that's in the leak, and that can be done chemically with filters and evaporators and things like that. But at the end of the day, when you think you have clean water, in that water is tritium, and tritium is called heavy water, and there's been a lot of cases around the country of tritiated water getting into the groundwater. It hasn't happened at Vermont Yankee yet, but Pilgrim has it just down in Massachusetts.
Hmm.
Oyster Creek has it. These are other boiling water reactors nearby. In New Jersey has tritium in the groundwater. So it's a little disingenuous to think that there's no radioactivity getting out.
So basically, the steam is leaked out somewhere and mixed with the cooling water. Is that how it gets out?
Well, just imagine, a leaky hose, in your garden. That leaky hose in a power plant goes into a drain, and that drain goes to radioactive waste because the leak is radioactive, and it's the different chemical isotopes that are radioactive, like cesium, strontium, and cobalt,
mm-hmm.
are stripped out. But at the end of the day, you can't strip out the tritium because it looks identical to water.
I see. So it sounds like...
You asked me about, getting back to your original question about cooling.
Yeah.
The turbine is cooled through the condenser.
That's
the thing that's on its last legs. But in addition, the nuclear fuel, if the plant shuts down, there's no need for the condenser. The plant is cool.
Uh-huh.
But because the nuclear fuel remains hot for many, many years, you still have to cool the nuclear fuel pool. And on Vermont Yankee, so you remember, it's a Mark I design. The fuel pool is in that real tall building that looks sort of like two boxes, one stacked on top of the other when you look at the pictures of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's right at the very top of that. And the very top of Vermont Yankee is not a concrete wall. It's a metallic wall. It's a pretty easily penetratable wall. And the Attorney General Sorrell and also the Attorney Generals from New Jersey and from Massachusetts have petitioned the NRC to take a look at these fuel pools because they are a very inviting terrorist target. Because they sit up so high, you could crash an airplane into them. You could, fire at them from a distance. Just go across the river into New Hampshire and fire at them with some sort of a weapon.
Mm.
And you could break the wall of the fuel pool and cause cause a meltdown. The water in the fuel pool, it needs to be cooled all the time. If there's no water in the fuel pool, the nuclear fuel in there will melt.
So if the pool is no longer viable, basically it's all over. It's a meltdown.
You got it. That's right. That's not what's in the reactor itself.
Yeah.
In the reactor itself, it's even hotter still. When a nuclear plant shuts down, it's not like turning off the burner on your stove. You turn it off and it gets cool real quick. When a nuclear plant shuts down, about 95% of the heat goes down right away, but about 5% continues to go, because even though the chain reaction is stopped, you have all sorts of radioactive decay going on for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
And so that radioactive decay continues to generate heat, which has to be cooled. And, you know, when you hear about this term China syndrome and emergency core cooling systems and things like that, the nuclear reactor core itself is, even if the nuclear chain reaction stops, at Three Mile Island, the chain reaction stopped, but we still had a partial meltdown because all of these decay products, they're called daughter products, give off a lot of heat, and 5% of the power from a reactor is in the form of these decay products. So you have to keep a nuclear reactor cool after it shuts down, unlike a coal plant. When a coal plant shuts down, it shuts down.
Mm-hmm.
When you turn off your burner on your stove, it's over. But you got to keep a nuclear plant. You got to keep the pumps running and the cooling water running, or else you will have a meltdown.
And maybe we should talk about decommissioning, perhaps. By the way, I should also stop and say we're talking to Arne Gunderson, who's a nuclear engineer and a nuclear industry safety expert. Is that fair to say?
I guess so.
Okay, I said it. So if the plant was to be decommissioned, that reactor would always have to be kept cool. Is that part of the decommissioning process?
The reactor would have to be kept cool, and pumps would have to be running for about 5 years.
Okay.
To keep the reactor fuel pool cool.
So eventually,
after about 5 years, the fuel would be taken out of the fuel pool and put into spent fuel storage containers. But the theory had been that those would go to Yucca Mountain out in Nevada.
Yeah.
But Yucca Mountain is no longer viable. So they're being stored on site. So if you go up to Maine Yankee, for instance, you know, there's a plant that after 5 years they dismantled the fuel pool, it put all the fuel into large canisters. And the canisters are sitting out on a pad, waiting to be sent to Yucca Mountain or some kind of geologic disposal. Those canisters are air-cooled by that point. After about 5 years, they can be cooled by air.
Mm-hmm.
But for the first couple of years, they have to be cooled by water. There's just too much heat given off.
And if they're not, if they're not cooled, they will melt down.
Without water for the first couple of years, they will melt down. And without air, you know, if the vents get plugged after that, they will melt down as well.
I see. So it's a fan blowing on them, or some kind of fan system?
No, it's natural.
Oh, it is. Okay.
They're passive. They sit upright, and cool air goes in the bottom, and hot air comes out the top. It's just a convective flow of heat.
I see. So, in the event of Vermont Yankee being decommissioned, what would happen? They'd shut the reactor down. They'd have to cool it for 5 years. Could they take the reactor away after that, or there's probably no place to take it? Is that correct?
Actually, there's a home for retired nuclear reactors. They sit them out on the desert in Washington State on a nuclear reservation out there.
Uh-huh.
And let's talk about that. What would happen? Let's assume for a minute that there's enough money to dismantle the plant.
Right.
And then we'll talk about what if they don't have the money. But if there was enough money to dismantle the plant, the plant would shut down, and a lot of the radioactivity decays away relatively quickly. So in the interest of not exposing the workers, you'd probably let the plant sit for a year or two, and then you'd begin to take apart the less radioactive equipment. Now, as it stands now, Vermont is in a compact with Texas, and it looks like we will have a place to send that to. Now, it's another problem on the horizon, but the plant will be very, very radioactive, and you've got to ship this somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But we're assuming we're going to ship it to Texas right now, and Texas is going to charge us for it to the tune of about $200 million to take the waste.
Mm.
So all this radioactive pipe and all the radioactive concrete gets put into drums and shipped to Texas, where it's buried in the ground in Texas. And you would start with the less radioactive areas until you got to the point where the only thing left would be this fuel pool and the containment building. And once the fuel was removed and put into canisters, that's about 5 years out,
mm-hmm.
The canisters are set outside on the parking lot. Then you could begin to dismantle the containment and the nuclear reactor vessel, that big pressure cooker. The pressure cooker would get picked up, put on a barge, shipped down the Connecticut River, through the Panama Canal, up the West Coast, and be stored in the desert at the Hanford Reservation. There are probably 20 or 30 nuclear reactor vessels there already. Those are very radioactive. But they're not anywhere near as radioactive as that nuclear fuel that's sitting on the site. So even if we knock down the containment building, we ship the nuclear reactor out, and which would go to Hanford, and we ship the pipe out, which went to Texas, and tore it all down, and we had a nice green field. Even if that happened, right now there's no place to send that nuclear fuel. So the nuclear fuel would sit on a pad on the site for an indeterminate amount of time until a long-term geologic. You got to put this stuff in a mountain.
Mm-hmm.
It stays radioactive for a quarter of a million years.
Wow.
So, it's loaded with something called plutonium, which is a carcinogenic isotope, and very, very small amounts of it can cause cancer.
Go ahead. Sorry, Ernie.
I
was just going to say,
sorry?
Can you the plutonium that's stored in those canisters, waiting for quarter of a million year storage? That's the fuel that's also is used to make nuclear bombs. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, the plutonium is used to make nuclear bombs. That's correct.
So that's potentially another terrorist hazard if it got into the wrong hands.
Yeah, there's two issues here with the plutonium. If the plutonium is stored on site, it's incredibly radioactive, and it's surrounded by lots of other radioactive things. So if it was a terrorist getting at it, they probably wouldn't have the technological capability to just peel off the plutonium and make a bomb.
I see.
Because it would be surrounded by so much other radioactive crap. On the other hand, they would have the capability to, you know, blow up a canister, in which case that plutonium becomes volatile, you know, enters the air and water, and there's one study that says you'd have to evacuate a circle with a 40-mile radius, which is essentially up to Springfield, Vermont, and down to Springfield, Massachusetts, if one of those canisters were to be breached.
And it wouldn't be a week-long evacuation, would it? It would be for a long period of time.
Yeah, it would be forever.
Like Chernobyl.
Yes, right.
I'd like to talk some about the politics of this nuclear plant operating and how it's supposed to close down. And it's interesting to me that you were, as the panel, looking at the viability of the plant. I'm not sure what the criteria you were looking at was, but that you were not allowed to look at the safety. And I understand the legislators who are deciding whether to relicense the plant are also not allowed to actually come to any conclusion about the safety of the plant. And can you talk about that some? Because I find that very Kafka-esque.
Yeah, I would agree with you. We were told loud and clear, the members of the panel were told loud and clear by the Public Service Board and by the Attorney General's office that if we ruled on the safety of the plant, Entergy would probably sue the state of Vermont and try to keep running, because it's not the domain of the state, it's the domain of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Now, which is why the panel then could look at, you can look at reliability, you can look at economics, you can look at whether or not we believe it's in the best interests of the state of Vermont to continue with an old power plant. My way of thinking of it that keeps it out of NRC space is to think of Vermont as a brand. Now, you're a brand manager. It doesn't matter whether it's Kellogg's Corn Flakes or Jack Daniel's whiskey or whatever. It's a brand, and it's in your best interest to make sure that that brand is untarnished. So if Vermont Yankee were to have an accident, let's go back 2 years, about 4 years ago, Vermont Yankee lost some nuclear fuel and couldn't find it.
That's
and,
right.
And that wound up on the Jon Stewart show. So twice. So it's not unheard of that they ultimately found it rolling around in the bottom of their nuclear fuel pool. They had lost it for 30 years. And they ultimately found it and put it back where it belonged. But there's a case of it making national attention in a relatively, as it turned out, nowhere near as important as a release of radiation in the future. But let's assume that Vermont Yankee has a minor accident and Route 91 has to be closed for 2 days. The image to the state would not end after 2 days. It would, there would be a negative image associated with the Vermont brand for years and years and years beyond that. Whether it's Cabot cheese or Ben and Jerry's milk or maple syrup or skiing or coming up to look at the foliage, I can just imagine the comments about the red leaves in Vermont or something like that if an accident were to happen. So my point is that while we cannot say the plant is safe or not, we're simply not allowed to say that, we can say, is it in the best interest of Vermont Yankee's of Vermont's brand to allow Vermont Yankee to run? Mm-hmm. So we're a green state. Now, Entergy will say that, well, Vermont Yankee doesn't emit any CO2, so that's good. But in the big picture, is it in the best interest of Vermont, brand of Vermont, to have a nuclear, an aging nuclear power plant, a 60-year-old nuclear power plant? And my belief is the answer is no. So I think the legislature can make a decision, is it in the best interest of Vermont as a brand, without stepping on the NRC's toes on safety.
I see. So that's sort of basically saying that there's a public perception of whether you like it or not or agree with it or not, there's a public perception of nuclear power as being potentially catastrophic. So that ruins our brand.
Yes, correct.
I see. So you're not ruling whether it's dangerous or not. You're just saying that that perception exists.
Right. Right. You know, and it goes beyond that, too. Vermont Yankee now sells power pretty cheap to Vermont. We get it for about 4.5 cents, and the rest of New England gets it for about 6 or 7. So we're making a penny or two compared to the rest of New England.
What percentage, Arnie, can I just interrupt for a second? What percentage do we use, and what percentage gets shipped out?
Yeah, more than half, 55% of Vermont Yankee's energy gets shipped out of state.
Okay.
We only use 45% of the power from Vermont Yankee.
Hmm.
So we only use 284 megawatts of the 640 megawatts from the plant.
I see.
Yeah, it's 55% leaves the state, mainly south.
Okay.
Mainly to Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New York State. Those are the big users.
I see.
So we have the risk, and they have the benefit.
Yeah.
And my way of thinking, that doesn't seem too fair. It's especially true on the decommissioning. You know, the fund is underfunded. We're $500 or $600 million behind where we need to be. And if we charged Entergy to fill that fund, 55% of that money would come from out of state, where the revenues are coming from, and only 45% would come from good old Vermont. Whereas if we let the plant shut down, at that point, if the plant is underfunded, it's all on us.
Mm.
And I don't think that's fair either. You know, there's the southern states, the Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New York, are picking up the benefit, and at the end of the day, they're not picking up the liability.
That would be an incentive for us if there was a risk-free way of running the plant to have the plant run as long as possible.
Right. Now, the other thing to remember is, first off, the deal we got with Entergy in 2002 expires in 2012. So the good rate we got with Entergy isn't there anymore. And Entergy isn't willing to give us a good rate again, which is why... they had said they were supposed to have the deal struck with Central Vermont and Green Mountain back in December. And here it is June, and they still don't have a deal. They can't agree on a price that's good for Vermonters. Entergy is saying, no, you're going to get market rates after 2012.
Hmm.
And the Vermont utilities are saying, baloney, that's not good enough. We want below market rates because of the risk you're putting on us. So we don't have a deal. So the advantages of keeping Vermont Yankee are negligible out beyond 2012 because we just don't have that big price differential that we had, you know, for the last couple of years. But the argument that Vermont Yankee's saving us a lot of money isn't true beyond 2012. We don't have a deal.
Yeah, every argument I've heard is basically just saying that we need cheap energy to fund industry in this state.
There's two arguments. What are we going to do without it?
Mm-hmm.
And we need cheap power. The cheap power argument is gone. Vermont Yankee is not willing to give us the deal they gave us for the first 10 years. From 2002 to 2012, that was a good deal.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's a good deal if you forget about the fact that we still don't have enough money in the decommissioning fund. That we probably saved... $100 to $200 million on the good deal we got on the electric rates since 2002. On the other hand, if we're stuck with $600 million to just dismantle the plant, it wasn't a good deal.
Right.
But if you just look at the raw cost of power and manage to forget the fact that, oh, by the way, we're going to owe $600 million more when this plant shuts down, the electric rates were a good deal for the last seven, eight years. Even out beyond 2012, that argument's over. They're not willing to give us a good deal in the future. The argument is, what are we going to do without them? You know, well, Green Mountain Power went out for bids. They asked for 100 megawatts of power in their bids, and they got 1,000 megawatts of bidders. So, and remember, for my Yankees, only 280. So there's more power out there than the grid needs right now.
Yeah.
They had willing bidders to replace Vermont Yankee. Now, some of those are wind farms. You know, every state in New England is further ahead of Vermont on wind farms. Maine is cranking out 100 megawatts, and Massachusetts has some. Even New Hampshire is putting some up. But we are lagging way behind. So some of that's wind, some of that's hydro, some of that is from gas turbines. And, of course, then Vermont Yankee says, well, you're replacing a source that doesn't produce CO2 with one that does. Well, the problem with that is that we have a three-year problem. We could replace Vermont's Yankee's energy. If we start right now, we could replace all of Vermont Yankee's energy with clean, renewable stuff by 2015. So for 3 years, we may have a bigger carbon footprint. But Vermont Yankee's proposing a 20-year solution, keep them licensed for another 20 years, solve a three-year problem. I've talked to the, you know, here in Burlington, we have the Woodburn and the McNeil plant.
Yeah.
And Vermont could, with sustainably harvested wood, have 2 to 3 other McNeil plants, and the McNeil plant is 60 megawatts. So that's 3 plants like McNeil is 180. We're almost there. Takes about 4 years to build a McNeil plant.
So we have to replace 240 megawatts. Is that what we have to replace with that?
We have to replace 280.
280, okay.
And McNeil, 3 new McNeils scattered around the plant would give us 180. And there isn't a person around who doesn't think we could conserve our way out of 100 megawatts.
Right.
We could save about 10% of the electricity we use through conservation. Vermont uses about 1,000 megawatts, so we could save about 10% of that. So that's 100 megawatts, which makes up the difference. Lots of things out there that could be online by 2015. It's not like the lights are going to go dark, one. And it's not like we're not going to have clean fuel after about 2015. There might be a couple of years where some of the fuel we use has a higher carbon footprint than Vermont Yankee. It's not an argument you can make for 20 years. There are sources available to us if we just do it.
Now, Arnie, when I talked to you 4 years ago or 5 years ago, we were talking about the uprate when Vermont Yankee was trying to increase its power outage, and they did get permission to do a 20% increase. And at that time, you told me that you were basically pro-nuclear. In theory, that you thought nuclear power could be operated safely. Do you still feel that's possible in the regulatory environment that we have today in this country?
Oh, that's a great, great question. Let me say it this way. Moving forward, we should never build another coal plant. We should never build another oil plant. Global warming is just too big a deal. Now, I believe that we can make all our new generation through renewable sources, looking forward, and that's solar or wind or hydro, not nuclear. Also, looking forward, the cost of new nukes are astronomical. You could build 4 times the amount of power from windmills as you can from one nuclear power plant. Nuclear plants are, on a per megawatt basis, about 4 times more expensive. But the wind doesn't blow all the time. But essentially, we're saying that windmills have now gotten to the point where they're as economical, if not more so, than a new nuclear power plant. You know, there's a great book. I don't think you can shut them all down today, so let me say that. There's a great book called Carbon-Free, Nuclear-Free by 2050. And it's on a website called IEER. And I can't remember what that stands for right now. But it's a, it's written by a guy named Dr. Arjun Makajani. And Arjun is a friend. And he works for a think tank in D.C. But he also worked for Tennessee Valley Authority back when Tennessee Valley Authority realized it was way, way, way overbuilding on its nuclear capacity. And he was responsible for restructuring the way Tennessee Valley Authority generated power.
Mm-hmm.
So the guy really knows his stuff. And he's laid out a blueprint that by 2050, not tomorrow, but over the next 40 years, we can, one, never build another nuclear power plant and replace all our oil and coal plants with renewables. It can be done. It should be done. Do I advocate shutting them all down right now? No.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of their license life, especially for these old units, I'd say absolutely yes. There's only two plants in the country that had a 20% uprate. One is Vermont Yankee, and the other is out in Clinton, which is out in the Midwest. The Clinton reactor is a Mark III. Remember, Vermont Yankee's a Mark I.
Yeah.
And I don't feel anywhere nearly as strongly about Clinton as I do about Vermont Yankee because the lessons that people learned over the years are dramatic, and it's a much better plant. So if you needed to keep Clinton running for another 20 years, I'd say, well, you know, it's a risk, but it's warranted. My thoughts on Vermont Yankee are not that. I don't think it's a risk that we should be taking.
So when people are talking to their legislators about this issue, the licensing is coming up in next year's legislative session, and they know that the legislators are not allowed to rule on the safety, which I think is probably what's foremost on most people's minds more than cost. Can your panel that you were a part of and can the legislature rule as to the cost efficiency of Vermont Yankee, and if they do that, can they factor in the decommissioning costs into that?
Yes, they can. You know, they can, in their heart of hearts, when they raise it, there's going to be a vote next year, and it's going to be, actually, if there is no vote, it's a vote to shut down. Actually, it has to be, we are not voting to shut it down. It will, if there is no vote, it will shut down.
Is that right?
So we have to vote it up. Mm-hmm. There has to be a majority to vote it up, not a majority to shut it down.
I see.
So the and if a legislature raises a hand, he wants to keep Vermont Yankee running, or he doesn't want to keep Vermont Yankee running, or she wants to keep it running, or she doesn't want to keep it running, that's all they have to say. The basis for that decision, you know, a yay or a nay, is something that, you know, in their heart of hearts, they know what the reason is, but it is not on the public record. So they can vote for it
for whatever
they don't think it's good for the Vermont brand. They can vote for it because their constituents don't like nuclear power or whatever. But at the end of the day, they cannot say they're voting for it because it's not safe.
I see. So, and you're saying if the legislature does nothing, the license expires.
Correct.
Correct.
So this year was actually a defeat for Vermont Yankee. You know, they had hoped to get the vote this year. So if the legislature does nothing next year and nothing the year after, the license expires. Now, Vermont Yankee has to buy fuel for 2012. And they said that they had to place that order in 2009. So if they buy fuel,
mm-hmm.
they're buying it because they think they might get approval, but you know, they were lobbying quite hard that they needed approval this year because they needed to buy fuel to run the plant, and that didn't happen.
I'm a little confused. So, yeah, why do you think they wouldn't have given us a sweet power deal? Because that would have worked to their advantage. Any thoughts on that?
If they had done that, probably would have tipped the balance. I think, though, the recessionary pressures in New England are pretty severe. You know, power this spring, we buy Vermont Yankee power at 4.5 cents.
Yeah.
Power this spring was selling for 3 cents.
Oh.
So the market, because fewer people are using electricity and people are conserving more, has a lot of people out there jostling for low-cost contracts.
Yeah.
So it's very hard for Vermont Yankee to give us a sweet deal because there's a lot of people that want to undercut that sweet deal and sell their power to Vermont. Had the recession not occurred, they might have been able to cut a sweet deal. But right now, there's such a large amount of power looking for a home in New England. 5,000 megawatts of power are looking for a home in New England. Remember, Vermont Yankee is only a tenth of that. So essentially 10 times more sellers than there are buyers. And that puts that's a great situation for Vermont to enter into some long-term contracts.
That's right, and to switch over to a new source of power, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Arne Gunderson, we're out of time, basically. Are there any websites or you recommended that one book on the IEER? What was it?
I'll give you there's three good websites that I can think of. One is actually a word. It's Beyond Nuclear.
Okay.
And it's one word, Beyond Nuclear, and they have a really great website which talks about alternatives. The second is IEER, and I think it's .org, but if you go IEER, you'll find it.
Mm-hmm.
And the third is NIRS, NIRS, Nuclear Information Resource Service. Those three are, and I know the people who work at all of them,
mm-hmm.
and this is credible science. This isn't... this isn't black magic, and credible science backed up by hard analysis. So it's Beyond Nuclear, NIRS, and IRS, and IEER are three really good websites for to continue the discussion.
Okay. Thank you so much, Arne. And we didn't get into talking about the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which I would like to discuss at some point in the politics of how they regulate, but maybe for another time.
Sure, I would love to.
Okay.
Talk about running out of money on the decommissioning fund, too.
Okay, that would be good. Great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye, Arne.
Bye-bye.
And we've been talking to Arne Gunderson, nuclear engineer and nuclear safety expert, part of the panel looking at Vermont Yankee for the state of Vermont. He was appointed by Peter Shumlin last year. And... also a whistleblower in the nuclear energy industry. The preceding show presented the views of its participants and did not necessarily represent the views of WMRW or its license holder RootsWork or any other organization. This has been Politics and Science for June 1st, 2009.